I'll call the Tourism, Infrastructure, and Energy Subcommittee to order. Ms. Regas, please call the roll.
Chair Drake.
Yes.
Vice Chair Lamarca. Ranking Member Schlossberg.
Here.
Representatives: Beltran. Brown. Buchanan.
Here.
Cheney.
Here.
Davis. Fine. Joseph.
In the house.
McFarland.
Present.
Roth.
Here.
Schoaf, excused. Silvers.
Here.
Skidmore. Trabolsi.
Here.
Williamson. Yarborough.
Here.
Quorum is present.
Thank you, Ms. Regas. I noticed you called Representative Schoaf, and he's unable to attend in person, but it's my understanding he is watching using some form of technology on his computer. I think they got those over in Gulf County where Representative Schoaf's at. But Representative Schoaf, if you're listening, we're praying for you, and we're thinking of you, and we know you'll be back soon. A couple of housekeeping items before we get started. If you don't mind, if you've got a phone or a laptop or an iPad or a watch or a beeper or something that goes off, you could put it on silent or vibrate. Presenters will be turning your microphones on for you, so you don't have to have that awkward moment where you're trying to find the button or see if it's on. Members, welcome to our first committee, our subcommittee on Tourism, Infrastructure, and Energy. Sorry I was a few minutes late, but Representative Schlossberg said that she was about to take over and drive this committee, so that for those of you that know her, that would be dangerous. But anyways, the work that we'll do here should be enjoyable. It'll be challenging, but I look forward to working with each and every one of you. We'll cover a broad subject matter, a broad range of issues from tourism to transportation to utilities, telecommunications. So I think we'll enjoy our time and service on this committee. And please feel free to be as expressive as you would like to be, or take moments of brevity. But we're here for a purpose. We've got work to do, important work, but it's okay to enjoy one another's camaraderie and have a good time while we're doing it, and in a friendly manner. And nothing's personal in this committee. It's all about doing what we're here and what we're tasked to do. So, and I'm extremely privileged to be chairing this committee and leading those efforts. I want to recognize our top brass with us. We have Vice Chair Representative Lamarca from Lighthouse Point. We also have Ranking Member Representative Emily Schlossberg from Boca Raton. Our Policy Chief, Mr. Cochran Keating. Our Administrative Assistant, Ms. Amanda Regas. Our Committee Analyst, Ms. Stephanie Johnson. And our Attorney, Mr. Michael Wilson. So we've got a great staff with a lot of expertise and experience on this committee, so always feel free to reach out to them. All right, we're going to go through a couple of presentations. We've invited a few people here to visit with us and talk a little bit about some of their expertise and some of the things that they work on that is of interest to us and to our speaker and to our mission as a committee. So let's start with tourism. We'll take up our first item on the agenda today and do an overview of the impacts of COVID-19 on tourism in Florida and the outlook from here looking forward. We know that tourism is our economic engine. It was hit the hardest last year and it continues to be impacted. Most of us are probably interested in knowing what the outlook and plan for recovery is. So without further ado, we've asked Ms. Amy Baker, who is the head of our Office of Economic and Demographic Research, to walk through some of the latest data and forecasts in this subject area. And Ms. Baker, if you are ready, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a pretty brief presentation. I'm just going to give you an overview of what happened right before the pandemic and what we're seeing now. So the technical assistance with getting this to the right place. But I believe you, let me just start talking to you about it a little bit. The first graph is the for the 2000, shows a period of time running from 2000 through 2019. And in the 2000 calendar year, Florida had 65,832,000 visitors. There was a couple of things that happened right after 2000. The first thing, if you'll remember, we had the dot-com recession that occurred in 2001. And then we also had the 9/11 event. So both of those things had an effect on what we were seeing as a part of tourism. So we actually dipped. When you see that slide, you'll see that we had a small decline. Thank you so much. We're going to go back one right here. So you can see in 2001, our tourism, which is that blue line running across the top, actually dipped slightly as a result of that. We had a fairly quick recovery, almost back to where we were before we had the dot-com recession. But then we slowed down again. We had SARS and the avian flu and a couple other things that affected international tourism more than anything else. After we got out of that period, so starting about 2004, we started to grow again at pretty normal growth rates, all the way coming into the Great Recession. When we hit the Great Recession from December 2007 through June 2009, it flattened completely out. So it was not just affecting the United States, but it was a global recession. And we saw both domestic and international travel just flatten out. It didn't really decline detectably. It slowed more than anything else. But coming out of the Great Recession, our first industry to recover in Florida was tourism. And it grew very, very strongly at rates we hadn't seen, in fact, all the way through 2019. So the last 5 years, we were seeing about an average of 6% growth per year, so very strong growth. And you can see it wasn't all domestic. The gap between the blue line and the red line was widening. That was because overseas or international travel was picking up a lot in terms of tourism. So when we finished 2019, we had 131,423,000 tourists. We had never seen that before. So our latest study, we do a study every year that looks at sales tax and how much money comes from tourists, how reliant we are on tourism. And so we just finished, actually this week, our latest study, which is fiscal year 2018-19. And what it showed to us is that tourism, direct expenditures by tourists in Florida, accounted for about 15% of all of our sales tax collections in 2018-19. That, again, was the highest share we had seen coming from tourists in our history of doing the studies. It's normally closer to 13%, 13.5%. So our sales tax collections are very sensitive to what tourists are doing. Then we hit the pandemic. The first cases were officially reported in China in December 2019. Now we're pretty sure it actually started in China earlier than that date. But by the end of Florida's 2020 regular session, the World Health Organization declared a global pandemic in March 11, 2020. Since then, and we're going to talk about these dates, that's why I'm going through them. Since then, we've gone through the first quarter of the calendar year, January, February, and March, and we actually had an outright decline in our economy, GDP. A recession was officially called by the NBER during that period. So it started a little earlier than people think in terms of having an effect on tourism and the economy. During the second quarter, which would have been April, May, and June, that's when we had our biggest decline in the economy. We went down by 31.4% across the United States. Florida's number was very similar to that. And then in the third quarter, we had somewhat of a rebound in July, August, and September. We saw that our growth for that quarter was actually 33.4%. So not back to normal, but a lot of immediate growth coming out of that first wave. So the reason I told you that is to show you these graphs. So these are graphs looking at Florida visitors. So the immediate impact, actually, we could see in quarter one. So in quarter one, the visitors that we received were only 93.7% of the prior year. So we were already, instead of seeing that 6% growth every year, we were already starting to drop back and experience the impact of people not traveling. By the time we hit quarter two, the bad quarter, we were only at 38% of the prior year in terms of our visitors to Florida, so much lower. And then by the time we hit quarter three, we were at 64.8%. So even though there was a lot of recovery in the economy, we still weren't anywhere near to our normal expectations for tourism. The other thing I would tell you is that there's a big difference at this point in time between air travelers and auto travelers. So the people traveling by air, you can see in that second quarter, they were only 14.6% of the prior year's numbers. And even after we recovered somewhat over the summer, they were only 34.2% of the prior year. The autos is recovering much quicker, and you can see that in those blue bars, especially in that bottom chart. The blue bars are approaching their normal levels, at least what we see in other years. It doesn't have growth, but it's approaching those normal levels. So auto by the third quarter was about 86.8% of the prior year. They're not necessarily the typical tourists we would see, but they people are traveling by car. Why this matters to us is we know that people who fly into Florida spend more money in Florida, and they typically stay longer in Florida. So if you shift to being more reliant on autos, even though it's good that you have some tourism, it doesn't have the same economic impact as your normal air travelers would. So in terms of where we are now, we know that Florida, as any high destination state, is very sensitive to what's happening with tourism. And we've done a lot of research over studies that have been done after prior pandemics or prior epidemics that are more regional in nature. And we know that tourism from those studies is the last industry to recover. And it takes at least a year from those regional epidemics to recover. And there's some reason to believe it's been longer for some of the other events that have hard hit different areas, like SARS. So looking at that data and that information, we know that since the magnitude of this pandemic is greater, we're going to be at the upper end of that range. And there's quite a few different tourism experts and industry folks that have put out their own forecasts, and 2 years is pretty much where everybody's settling on right now. So not only is the Florida Economic Estimating Conference looking at that, the industry sector folks also believe that's the case. So we don't believe, from that slide we looked at just a moment ago, where autos are coming back so quickly, what we don't believe is that all tourists will start coming back together. We believe it's going to be segmented and scattered through. So the first one to come back are leisure driving vacations. And we're starting to see that happen already. The next group that would come back would be business travel, although we have some concerns about that that I'll talk about in a second. Then your air travelers, your domestic air travel and your international travel. So our in the Economic Estimating Conference and in the General Revenue Conference, our forecasts generally follow that shape. So you can see it in the graph at the bottom. The blue bar is the pre-pandemic estimate. It's the one we made a year ago in January and what we were expecting to see. The red line shows you what our current thinking is on how tourists are going to come back to Florida, thinking of those stages of people coming back in. And you can see we had the big, sharp decline, and then we have kind of a boost coming back, and then it flattens out before we return to normal. That's caused by the assumption that we've made an economic estimating conference that there will be a vaccine widely deployed by next summer. If that's true, we would expect a bounce back at that point in time. So we would start seeing things pick up and very, you know, strong recovery over the course of that year. So 2021 will still be low. By the time we hit 2022, you can see we have pretty sharp growth. From that point forward, we think it'll be more slow recovery, but that we should be approaching normal enough to say that we've recovered by 2024. So that's our current expectation. This shows you a very similar picture, but this is looking at sales tax. So I mentioned earlier that our average fiscal year growth, so we've switched from calendar years to fiscal year growth, over the most recent 5 years is about 6.1%. And so that's what we had come to expect as normal growth. In the 10 months of sales tax collection data we've had since the pandemic started, our sales tax in this category is down 31.5%. So it is improved, but it's nowhere near back to normal, and is starting, in the very most recent data that we released yesterday, starting to slip again. What we look at is, we bear in mind with this data, it's not just, even though the category is labeled tourism, it's not just tourists in this category. It's also in-state our residents that are traveling to different parts of the state, their activity at restaurants, their activity at local attractions, and their other leisure-based activities. And they were affected too. So all of those things are coming together to hit this one category particularly hard. So there has been some recent research that's come out. The report that I'm noticing here is the Skift Research and McKinsey and Company. They've been looking at what's been happening, talking to industry folks, doing some analysis. They brought in some different universities to assist them. And so a couple key things to us. They note that travelers are keen to travel, but are restrained in the leisure space by the inability to do anything meaningful at the destination due to necessary public health measures and safety precautions, such as quarantines, closures, and other restrictions. So what they're saying is people aren't scared to travel, they just don't feel like it's an appropriate time to travel, which there is some good news for us that speaks to how quick some segments will recover. They also note that business travelers may be further limited by corporate travel policies developed in response to the pandemic that reflect the company's focus on its duty of care obligations to employees. Also affecting this is a lot of businesses are considering making permanent some of the remote working opportunities that were available during the pandemic, and also learning to use telecommunications in new ways and to a greater degree. So all of that is coming into play as well. What they recommend, based on the research they've done and the industries they've spoken to, is that states spend time focusing on talking about nearby vacations, outdoor venues that are located in the state, and other things that kind of get your folks within your state to move around the state. So not, for example, for Visit Florida, it's not their typical client. That's not who we spend most of our advertising on. But this is the piece that's most available to us now. They also recommend that you spend a lot of time breaking up your market. And so instead of doing broad-based campaigns, that you think of things that people would feel comfortable doing, you focus on those and on the people who would be interested in those things. So that's basically the most recent guidance. Visit Florida is doing some of this today already. They're already focusing on what opportunities are available to get people to move around the state. A couple other big states are also focusing on this at this point. So that's where we are right now, Mr. Chairman. This is the update.
Thank you, Ms. Baker. Members, having heard the presentation, each and every one of us represents a beautiful area of the state that a lot of people enjoy coming to visit and are tourists in our community. So do we have any questions for Mrs. Baker regarding her presentation on tourism?
Got one behind
you. Representative Cheney, you're recognized.
Thank you for the presentation. I'm from Pinellas County, South Beaches, so we're very much a tourism-based community. Can you tell me where Florida ranks among the rest of the country in terms of tourism destinations post-COVID?
In terms of, Mr. Chairman, in terms of their performance?
In terms of visitor volume, visitors coming to Florida versus other states?
Oddly enough, we were not, even though we're one of the top states for the attractions we have, the beaches, and the number of visitors that come here, we actually weren't the hardest hit of the state. Hawaii was hit incredibly hard by the pandemic and its effect on tourism. Nevada was hit pretty hard for the same reason. So because of the volume, I think because of the volume of outdoor activities we have, that's kept us going a little bit more than others have been able to do. I think it's also related to the fact that people can drive to Florida. Obviously, that's not even feasible in Hawaii, and Nevada for all of the East Coast isn't a possibility. And California was hit pretty hard with the disease itself. So we, as bad as it is, I think we're lucky compared to some of our peer group and tourist destinations.
Representative from Pinellas County, any additional questions?
Do you have a ranking? Are we like in the top three, top five in terms of tourism post-COVID?
Mr. Chairman, we can share that with you and get it to you. We're very high on almost every metric.
Thank you. Representative from Hillsborough County, you recognize.
Thank you, Chairman. I guess my question is this. We didn't really appreciate maybe the scope of COVID till maybe March of last year in terms of folks canceling trips and so forth, and we don't have data for the first quarter of 2021 for very good and obvious reasons. Obviously, it looks like you're still compiling data from the last quarter of last year. But my question is, can you give us any guidance on what's going to happen this quarter? We're three or four weeks into the new year now. And what are you seeing in terms of any leading indicators there? Because that's when we make most of our money, right? It's the first quarter. So maybe you could speak to that.
Yeah, it is a very important quarter to us for a variety of reasons. That's when our snowbirds are here. That's when we see a lot of interest coming from international tourists. And then we kind of finish that first quarter moving into spring break. So those are all very high-powered impact events to us. Probably, I mean, there is some data on, for example, hotel rooms, emplanements, things like that. Probably the best peek that we have at it right now is looking at sales tax and how those collections are coming in. So I mentioned that we actually had just gotten December posted yesterday. So this is for that chart up there is for the tourism category. You see we've kind of been slipping. We've gotten improved to when we hit October, -17.4%, November with -20.2%, and December was -25.5%, so we're slipping a little bit. Sales tax collections lag a month. So when we show December, it was November activity. Or when we show November, it's October activity. So what that tells you is after that kind of brief burst in the summer, things are starting to slow down a little bit as we move into January. And that was one of the things the General Revenue Estimating Conference spent a lot of time talking about, that where you have your volume of international tourists, where you have your volume of Canadians, is just hitting right now. And those are folks that spend the most. So if you look across different categories, our overseas visitors are in the mid group of all visitors, but they spend a long time when they're here. Same thing for Canadian visitors. They're a little lower spending, but they spend a long time. So it's possible we're going to see a greater negative impact coming from this quarter, but not necessarily a worsening of conditions, but we're going to have lost the big volume of people that usually help us.
Thank you. Representative from Palm Beach County, you're recognized. Welcome back to the Florida House.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Baker. I appreciate all this information. On slide 2, where we have 15% of our sales tax comes from tourism, understanding that some of that is intrastate, is that a vulnerable percentage for us in comparison to other states? Should we be looking at some alternatives, or is that a reasonable amount that we can carry, so to speak?
Ms. Baker.
It is a very interesting question, because tourism, if we go back to the Great Recession, is what brought Florida out of the Great Recession as quickly as we came out. So our housing market, our construction market, were lagging and very slow to recover. And so the recovery we saw was totally driven by tourism. And that's not just from a revenue perspective, but it's also from an employment perspective. So the tourism employment sector, or leisure and hospitality, is very large, has a lot of people in it, and they were able to return to work and recover very quickly. And so that helped all of our metrics for the state. We were, all the way through 2019, we were being bolstered and helped by this extraordinary growth we had in tourism. So it is a risk, though, when you have something like a pandemic. And so we think we'll recover. It's just this is gonna be the longest period for any industry to recover from the pandemic. So we are extraordinarily reliant on tourism. It was a good thing for the state all the way through 2019. We're in a bad place right now, but you know, by 2024, we probably are about back to the same mix we had before.
Thank you, Ms. Baker. Representative from West Palm Beach, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. I'm from Palm Beach County, and obviously tourism is a huge impact in Palm Beach County, and we're starting to see more aircraft travel, obviously. I would like a little more information or maybe a little more insight. When you talked about how people that are traveling by air tend to stay a little bit longer and spend more money versus driving by car, I didn't know if that was – is it similar pattern under the pandemic as it is historically? Because I could see that, you know, Canadians, New Yorkers flying down, staying for the whole season versus somebody coming for a one-week stay coming by car. So is that a similar pattern or is it different? And I'm trying to understand how you kind of get that number. How you come to that number that the people that are flying or spending more money?
So we work with Visit Florida, and not only my office, EDR, but the Economic Estimating Conference. They produce a massive amount of data from looking at expenditures, looking at what people do, how long they stay, from hotel room bookings, from lots of different sources. And so from those sources, we know for each year pretty much what the typical stay is and what they spend per day. So like for AIR, for 2019 calendar year, we knew that they spend about $205 per day, and they stay on the average about 4.5 days. For auto, they spent about $137 per day and stayed on average about 4 days. So there is a difference there. And so we feel comfortable over years of looking at this data and working with Visit Florida and a number of changes they've made to answer some of our questions over the years, that's solid data. We do not have any data yet for 2020. We're hopeful that we will be able to get some preliminary looks at it, but we don't have anything at this point for that.
Any additional questions for Ms. Baker? Seeing none. Ms. Baker, thank you very much. Okay, the second item on our agenda is we're going to provide an overview of broadband deployment to rural and underserved portions of Florida. As many of you know, access to broadband service has become essential for economic development, and further highlighted by the COVID-19 pandemic, broadband service is essential for online education and health care for remote work. Still, many portions of our state lack access to this service. Today's presenters will address some of the challenges to expanding service and the efforts being made to reach underserved homes and businesses. To start the discussion, we have invited Mr. Dane Eagle, the Executive Director of the Department of Economic Opportunity, to be with us today. Mr. Eagle, you are certainly recognized, and we welcome you back to the Florida House of Representatives and to this committee. Thank you for being here, and you're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman Drake, and thanks for the opportunity of being here. Vice Chair LaMarca, Ranking Member Schlossberg, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity. As many of you may know, I was invited to lead the Department of Economic Opportunity by our governor in September. I'm honored by that opportunity. Look forward to working with each and every one of you in the many aspects that we work with. One of those is the Office of Broadband, the newly created Office of Broadband, which I was invited to discuss with you today. Just to give a little bit of background on Florida's Office of Broadband, Governor DeSantis signed House Bill 969 into law just this past year. It was effective July 1st, 2020. That bill was sponsored by the one and only very fine gentleman, someone I hold in high regard, a guy by the name of Brad Drake, did a wonderful job and had a lot of foresight in that, as we all know now. Obviously, broadband is important to our state in any time, but in the world we're in now, where telehealth, the ability to learn online, to work from home, has become ever more important. So broadband has become much more important in our lives today than it was when this bill was passed just this last session. So the Florida Office of Broadband is within our department and is created with three main things in mind: developing, marketing, and promoting broadband internet service in the state. In order to achieve those three things, there are four very prescriptive items in statute that this bill passed. Number one is to create a strategic plan. Number two is to build and facilitate local technology planning teams. Number three is to encourage the use of broadband internet service with a highlights and a focus in rural and unserved and underserved areas. And number four is to participate in the Federal Communications Commission proceedings. So we've had quite a short time, especially in COVID time, to work on this, but our office has been very, very busy in getting this up and running. And so far, as you can see with these tasks ahead of us, we've worked with the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, the U.S. Department of Commerce for information on mapping projects, which is very important to understand where the needs lie, what the speeds are, and how we can improve those. We've worked with the Broadband USA team to identify resources and best practices in other states. Why reinvent the wheel when we can look to what other states have been doing to progress? We've attended NTIA and Broadband USA telemeetings. We continually review Federal Communications Commission meeting agendas. We are currently in the process of implementing regional workshops. We've partnered with our Florida regional councils across the state, which are 10 of those, and we're hosting the virtual workshops, which the first one started today and will be ongoing through the next month. These sectors include education, healthcare, private business, community organizations, agriculture, tourism, parks and rec, economic development, local government, and internet service providers, which was outlined in that statute. All virtual workshops, as I mentioned, started today and will go through February 12th. And here is a list of those. Our office should have sent this program to each and every one of you. If you need further information, please feel free to reach out to us. Happy to discuss after this meeting. But we are certainly encouraging as much participation as possible in these online virtual workshops so that we can begin to, of course, continue to implement the Office of Broadband and work on our strategic plan. So we are currently working on securing funding to establish a three-phase approach for the implementation of broadband expansion. We've applied for a $3 million grant with the federal government. And that three-phase approach would start with a feasibility study to specify the nature of the connectivity gap and why it exists, and that's looking at that map of Florida. Where are the gaps? Where are the speeds lacking? Where is there, you know, really no connectivity possible? The strategic plan and assessing the strategies and being able to bring broadband to those areas that it does not exist, and, of course, implementing those plans. So looking forward, we'll continue to host these virtual workshops with various industry and community leaders in mind, and you'll hear from some of those today. We'll conduct that feasibility study to identify the status of broadband, the availability, the access, and the affordability. We'll create the strategic plan, which is mandated in the statute, to be able to review internet availability, accessibility, and transmission speeds in Florida, and design state programs and resources for broadband adoption, deployment, expansion, and resiliency. Mr. Chairman, that is very briefly in a nutshell, the Office of Broadband. You know it well, but I'm open to questions and turn it back to you.
Thank you, Director Eagle. Any questions for the director? Yes. Representative from Sarasota County, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. I recently saw that Florida got, I believe it was $191 million from FCC for broadband development. Does that flow through the Office of Broadband?
Thank you, Chairman. No, it does not. Those awards were given directly to the entities. I have a list of those, happy to provide afterwards. That's a 10-year program as well, and they are there's certain communities that they are going to be actively working in. I imagine the speakers coming after this can talk a little bit about that as well. So we do not administer those funds, but we will be working with them and mapping how it's done and really kind of documenting how the plan is moving forward and being a resource to everybody implementing those funds.
Additional questions? Representative from Miami-Dade County, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to see you. So my question is about the underserved areas. How is that defined, and how does that impact the urban areas? And if those are included, which I'm assuming they are, but correct me if I'm wrong, what are your outreach efforts?
You're recognized.
Chairman. The definition of broadband and what is underserved is by the download and upload speeds. I'll get you those exact numbers. I'm not the IT expert when it comes to that, but that is the how we would determine who's underserved. Basically, no broadband or not high technology broadband. You know, not good download or upload speeds. And then working and being able to communicate with those areas, we're really looking at the regional planning councils, and then we would be working with those communities that have been identified to be underserved. And focusing on those areas. Off the broadband, we certainly want to look at Florida as a whole, but in statute, we are prescribed to focus on those underserved areas, so that's where our focus will be.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
Let me be more specific. Are any of those underserved areas in Miami-Dade, Broward, or Palm Beach County?
We'll get back to you on that.
Additional questions? Representative from Duval County, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Hi, Dane. How you doing? I know we have the MCORS project, the HB 969, and in that project, we were dealing with up to $5 million annually. Can you talk to us about the implementations, I guess you want to do, with broadband with those dollars and cents?
Thank you, Chairman. And very good point. Yes, $5 million was allocated last year. Those funds are not available until, I believe, the 2022-2023 fiscal year. Those are given to the Department of Transportation, so they're not with us at DEO. However, we are working hand-in-hand with Department of Transportation as they develop the MCORS projects. They're going through similar process that we are now, and we're communicating with them. They hope to go through those findings this fall and be able to present that to you, the legislature, in the 2022 session and how they plan to implement those funds.
Representative from Boca Raton, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question. Are there any regulatory or legislative obstacles in the way, other than, I think we know we need some financing and some funding available to be able to reach all the underserved communities, but are there any zoning or permitting or any other kinds of issues that are obstacles to expanding broadband?
Thank you, Chair. I would say funding is certainly the number one. We were not allocated funds at DEO. However, we're using our infrastructure. What I mean by infrastructure is our current resources and office staff to be able to implement that, and we're doing so just fine. If we want to be able to administer grants and actually work on infrastructure, things like that, funding would certainly come into play. We're not asking for that at this time. I think we want to put out the strategic plan first and then certainly have a much broader conversation about that. We haven't run into any other big roadblocks yet, as far as permitting or government regulations go. But as we go through those, we would certainly bring those findings to you with assistance to break down those barriers.
Additional questions? Representative from St. Lucie County.
Thank you, Chair.
Fort Pierce, you're recognized.
Thank you. Once you identify the greatest areas of digital divide, how will you prioritize the implementation?
You recognize.
That's a great question, and that will be a part of the strategic plan that we're developing, so I can't answer that just yet, but we'd certainly invite input on that as we put that together.
Thank you.
Questions for Director Eagle? Seeing none. Sir, we thank you for being here, and stick around. We may have some additional questions at the end, but we appreciate your presentation.
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee.
You acted like you've done that before from right there. Our next presenter is Ms. Christy Mason with Lumen Technologies, formerly known as CenturyLink. Ms. Mason, if you are ready, you are recognized to present. Let's, Ms. Mason, let's make sure, will her mic from the table work, or does she need to go to the podium? Okay. Now I have to correct that I fabricated what I said earlier and that we would be turning on the microphones for you, but just at, you guys just turn your mics on whenever you get ready, and if you're comfortable presenting there, you're welcome to present there. But Ms. Mason, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman. Committee members, I'm Christy Mason, the Director of Government Affairs for Lumen Technologies. Thank you for inviting me here to discuss broadband availability in the state of Florida. I'd like to take a second and familiarize you all with Lumen Technologies. We are a global communications provider to consumers and enterprise businesses with a network of over 450,000 global route miles, and we serve customers in over 60 countries. This past fall, CenturyLink rebranded its parent company to Lumen. We have three brands. We are maintaining the CenturyLink brand for our copper-based services. We will be rolling out our new Quantum Fiber brand, which will be fiber-based services in select markets. And the third brand under our parent company is Lumen, which represents the enterprise market. Lumen's footprint in Florida spans the entire state. We have over 1 million connections statewide. and an investment of over $7 billion, encompassing more than 30,000 route miles of fiber. Focusing on our CenturyLink brand, we provide high-speed internet and voice services to residential and business customers in 36 counties across the state. In today's competitive market, it's important to remember how we got where we are. During the monopoly era, we provided phone service to customers in designated local service territories, and our local service territory under the CenturyLink brand has the same footprint today. So just for perspective, it took a federal program and federal subsidies over 50 years to ensure that every American that wanted access to quality phone service was able to get it. In order to ensure that every American who wants high-speed internet can purchase it for a reasonable price, it's going to require the best efforts of service providers employing all available technologies supported by a funding mechanism to support customers in the most sparsely populated areas. Lumen continues to invest. In 2020, we invested more than $200 million in Florida alone. Lumen is constantly evaluating opportunities and seeks strong business cases to support expansion of our fiber network. It's important to recognize that building out a fiber network is costly. We make reasonable or responsible business decisions. To place a mile of fiber, it costs anywhere from $30,000 to $50,000, depending on how and where it's placed. So take, for example, if we were to place a mile of fiber to serve one customer at the $50,000 rate per mile, it would take more than 83 years to recover the investment from a customer paying $50 a month. Something to note, when we expand our network, we have no way of knowing how many customers will actually purchase that service and how long they will keep our service because we are all in a competitive market. In general, CenturyLink charges the same prices for services supplied in rural areas as we do in our urban areas. So this is a prime example of why it's going to take all technologies in order to serve every last American. The FCC has been working to bridge the digital divide. The Connect America Fund was created to provide support to certain qualifying telephone companies that serve high-cost areas. Under the CAF program, CenturyLink was able to expand broadband service to over 34,000 homes and businesses in rural Florida. The FCC recently announced the launch of RDOF, which is the Rural Digital Opportunity Fund, and this program will direct $20.4 billion to expand broadband in unserved rural areas. And the FCC is also currently working on updating maps to show customers or show addresses that are unserved, underserved, and well-served. There are several ways that states can assist their constituents with the digital divide. One of the ways would be setting up broadband grant programs. North Carolina has a state program, and Lumen has found this program to allow for economic expansion in areas otherwise uneconomic. The North Carolina program sponsors 70% of the actual project cost and allows for local governments to coordinate and contribute to that project. We're recently awarded in grants in North Carolina to build more than 44 residential and business locations with gigabit service. Another way for states to assist with the deployment of broadband would be to offer a tax exemption for eligible telecommunications providers who deploy broadband technology. This type of tax incentive would encourage investment in the infrastructure needed to develop high-speed internet access throughout the state. Ensuring that every American is well connected to the wider digital world will require leveraging every technology solution available for providing service and a local government funding mechanism to assist with reaching customers located in high-cost areas.
Thank you, Ms. Mason. And I'm sure there are some questions, but if you would hold off and we'll let the other two presenters finish their presentation because they're all going to be kind of linked together in the nature of their presentation. But we've been authorized some time. Vice Chair LaMarca moves that we extend the meeting for 15 minutes. Show that done without objection. That way you guys don't have to rush through your presentation. We weren't going to let you off the hook either. So I know you were looking to see we only had 7 more minutes. But hold your questions that you may have for Ms. Mason. Congratulations. And we'll move to our next presenter, Mr. Charlie Dudley, representing the Florida Internet and Television Mr. Dudley, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Charlie Dudley, I'm the general counsel for the Florida Internet and Television Association. This is my 31st session, so I've seen a little bit of change in communication policy. You would know our association by our members, and I apologize, I'm going to need some defogger probably before I'm done today. But it's Comcast, Charter, Mediacom, Cox, and Atlantic Broadband that have traditionally been known to you as your cable provider. I think when you begin to talk about broadband, we've got to define what that is. The bill that the chairman worked on last year in Florida defines broadband as 10 megabits in the downstream and 1 megabit in the upstream. I think as we've learned with COVID, that speed's probably not adequate enough. The FCC defines it as 25 megabits in the downstream and 3 megabits in the upstream, and that's probably the definition you want to look to, because we've got obviously multiple users in a household or a business now that are drawing on that network connectivity empower multiple devices and to do multiple things in the household, whether it's your children studying online, whether it's a parent or both parents trying to work from home, doing virtual meetings or calls, and then later on in the night or even during the day trying to stream movies to have entertainment. All those things draw on the network, and I think you'll find that 25.3 is probably the minimal benchmark that you want to use, and I think that's something just to keep in mind as we're talking about that. So in my world, you are unserved if you don't have access to 10.1 at a minimum or 25.3. You may be considered underserved if you're in an area with high usage and 25.3 still does not provide enough bandwidth to do the things you want to do, because in a lot of areas you have a shared network where multiple folks and multiple households and businesses are drawing down on that signal. The RDOF funding, Representative McFarland asked about, the federal government released awards for $9.2 million. 11 providers in Florida were awarded in 56 counties for different projects, including, to Representative Joseph's question, some projects in the three South Florida counties that you asked about, and we do have a spreadsheet on that for you. We don't know the details of those awards because the FCC is in a quiet period. And on Friday, all the award winners are supposed to submit detailed plans for how they would spend that money. And then the FCC will spend several months looking at that before they actually physically award the dollars. In the interim, the FCC is spending about $65 million to update their maps. They've been using a census block approach, which has proven inadequate because a census block is too large. And there may be services provided in part of the census block, but not the whole census block, and therefore the census block is considered served when it's not. So they're updating those maps to include something called a shape file. And I'm not a shape file expert, but it is a piece of logistical data, I'm told, that overlays the census block and allows them to more accurately reflect where there is service. And that's being done. And some of that money was in the federal stimulus fund that passed. There is another $11 billion in RDOF money that's round two of the $20 million that Ms. Mason recommended or talked to you about. That's going to be coming out later this year. There was actually $7 billion in the stimulus bill that was signed by the president over the holidays. And some of that money, I think $290 million, went to historical black colleges and tribal universities to help students and faculty with access. $300 million went for additional unserved areas. $3.2 billion went for adoption programs, Representative Joseph, for those who can't afford broadband or qualify based on their income level. So there's quite a bit of federal money, and I think it's great that Representative Eagle and his team is trying to get Florida focused on how we take advantage of that, because obviously we're donating that money in the form of taxpayer dollars to the federal government. I would think you'd want to get as much of it back to help our citizens as we can. In Florida, the data varies, but most people agree that 95 to 97% of Floridians have access to broadband. 95 to 97, that means we're talking about a problem in the rural areas or the unserved areas that's somewhere to 3 to 5%. Now, that's a small percentage, but I understand that's a large number of households and businesses, so we're all going to have to work together. To Ms. Mason's point, using all available technology, in a process to try and drive broadband availability to the pockets of Florida that don't have it. So we need to leverage federal dollars. I applaud the DEO for that. We've got RDOF, we've got other federal dollars, and we need to focus on these unserved areas. Representative, you asked about barriers or the problems that are out there. So Florida, under this legislature, I think has done a great job of streamlining local regulations, creating shot clocks for permits. Those are all very helpful. We're trying to work through those as local governments adopt new ordinances, and I think most of them want to work with the industry to try and get as much technology deployed in a timely, safe manner as we can. That's been especially important to our networks during COVID. The cable networks have seen some incredible usage patterns that over the last 9 or 10 months, not just in rural areas, but in urban areas where, like I said, everyone is at home and everyone's trying to do everything at the same time on the network. So we're very proud, and that's because our industry's invested about $10 billion over the last decade to get us where we're at, and we're here to invest more. I think from a tax perspective, I agree with Ms. Mason. Some states, I think 20-some-odd states have done some sort of broadband tax deployment, tax credit or tax rebate or tax exemption for equipment that qualifies, and I think that's something that you definitely should look at in Florida. We understand this may be a difficult time fiscally to do something like that, but I think it's something you should take the time to learn more about and take a look at that. For those of you that are returning to the legislature, you know about the communication services tax. We are the ninth highest state in the country in taxing customers on their communications bills, and that's something that the legislature was about to pass a reduction last year before COVID changed the tax package at the very end, as some of you may recall. That was disappointing, I think, to our customers and the companies, but we clearly understand that the timing was wrong for that. That's probably something that should remain on your list. And the other item you're going to come across in these rural unserved areas is what we call pole attachment rates. There's a federal law that regulates the investor-owned electrics, your FPNL, Gulf Power, your Duke, and your TECO. They have a regulated rate and a regulated term and condition in which we pay them and negotiate with them to access them and pay per pole per year for access. However, the federal law does not govern rural electric co-ops or municipal electrics, and those rates are 2 to 3 times higher than the regulated rates. So I think you're going to see proposals to take a look at that issue as well. Finally, I guess I would talk about a couple different final issues before passing on to Casey. But number one is that we do need to do a better job of communicating. I was happy to work with DOT this summer. I was on all three MCOR's broadband seminars and actually did another seminar with state and local transportation planners. We need to do a better job of, when we acquire right-of-way, making sure we've acquired enough. We need to set aside right-of-way, and we're doing road projects so that we can go back in and install broadband communications, whether it's a wire or whether it's wireless. We need to do a better job of getting the companies together with local governments and road planners. When we're changing road alignment, there's a lot of networks that get disrupted, and we have to move those networks to get out of the way, and that's very expensive, and that drains capital away from our ability to extend networks. And so I'm not being critical of anybody. It's just that we've got to get to a next stage level of strategic planning and thinking about how to do things better going forward. You know, some people may say, well, you're just reducing the cost of doing business. Well, we're suggesting to you that you need to do that in order for us to have the capital to deploy to the final 3 to 5% of Florida. And then finally, Mr. Chairman, on adoption, and I'll stop. All of our companies have an Internet Essentials type or a Connect to Compete program that targets students and families of the low income. It unfortunately has a very low subscription rate. We're happy to partner with you on that. We're now working nationally with school districts to help them help us identify the students and the families that qualify for that program. It's several months of free broadband service, and then it's about a $9 product for the months after that. And there's hardware options and training that goes along with it. We think it's a wonderful program. It's something the industry's really picked up after the COVID. And so we look forward to working with, Mr. Chairman, with your committee over the next couple years, and available for any of the members that want to dig in any deeper on these issues. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Dudley. Our last presenter is Mr. Casey Reed, representing AT&T. Mr. Reed, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members. I'm Casey Reed, Vice President of Governmental Affairs and Policy for AT&T Florida. Before I get started on my part of the program here, I just want to adopt some of the comments made by Charlie. I always enjoy going after him because he covers most of what I was going to. Just in terms of the FCC mapping, I think, as Director Eagle talked about, you know, having a strategic plan, having a target in place as we try and address some of the challenges that we have in deploying broadband would be smart. Also, the question about the regulatory environment. This legislature for over 20 years has taken a pro communications industry stance, starting with the CST, which Charlie helped write, and going through statewide franchising, eliminating local barriers to it, permitting that we've done in the past to expedite that. So as far as regulatory environment, we certainly would want to see that trend continue, and it only helps. As Charlie mentioned, nearly half the states do not tax network infrastructure, broadband infrastructure. Florida is not one of those. We still do pay sales tax on this. So if we're talking about economic development tools, those are certainly things we would encourage you to look at. And then, you know, quickly, just to touch on that 95 to 97, have some type of service available, and the numbers vary, but they indicate 70 to 80% of people are subscribing. So that leaves you almost a 20% gap between available services and people that are taking advantage of that. Director Eagle touched on some of the challenges to that, which are access, affordability, and awareness of services. Before I get into the access issue, I do think affordability is clearly an issue. As Charlie mentioned, we do offer low-cost services. Ours is called Access, which we're happy to provide information to you on. But clearly it's not enough. So we are encouraging at the federal level some type of reformation of the Lifeline program that was designed to deal with phones, applying that in some way to help low-income people get a voucher so they can choose whatever provider they want. Thankfully, to this legislature's leadership, Florida has one of, if not the most robust communications industry in the nation. You have two satellite providers, multiple cable providers, all of your wireless providers all operate here in Florida, which is not true in other states that have more onerous regulations on the industry. But what I really want to touch on, and what I think AT&T represents in this conversation, aside from fixed deployment of wired fiber, is what we talked about in emerging technologies, talking about utilizing all of those technologies. AT&T is one of the unique companies that provides both fiber and wireless. And so we, just as a snapshot of AT&T over the last 3 years, AT&T has spent $3.3 billion deploying and upgrading our network infrastructure throughout Florida. We serve around a million and a half homes. And just in the last year alone, we have deployed 122 new macro cell towers and deployed 563 new small cell sites. So, you know, we're out there deploying. We're trying to keep up with demand. As Ms. Mason mentioned, you know, we chase the customer. We do not have the ability to just lay out an investment and hope people come and utilize the services. To that end, you know, AT&T, we believe that wireless is something that needs to be a part of this discussion, whether that's a fixed wireless solution. It was mentioned earlier, the Connect America Fund, the second round of that funding really focused a lot on fixed wireless. AT&T was one of those providers. That is a line of sight technology that basically we put a huge pole up on your property and it looks right at the cell tower and shoots back a signal. I know that it's much more cost effective. We look at that, but then we also like to think of mobile alone as something that can address a lot of these challenges. If you think of after a hurricane, after a storm, which many in Florida have a lot of experience with, you know, the first way you access the internet, typically if power goes out or something, is you grab your cell phone and you utilize that to have connectivity information and whatever. In a lot of areas, you're getting better than 25.3 speed across your wireless network. To that end, AT&T, as a part of those towers that we've deployed, we have a federal partnership with called FirstNet, which is our commitment to deploy and create a new first responder broadband network, wireless network that can be accessed by our consumer network in times that it's not needed by first responders. That commitment is $40 billion nationwide, and we are to cover nearly 99% of populated areas of the nation, including Florida. So we think over time that deployment will take some time, but eventually we would like to see people have wireless if they're not able to get a wired signal, that they have some type of cellular connectivity. We see the coverage of that increasing at the same time that the cost disparity between data plans mobily and what you're getting internet at home are starting to become comparable. So I think that as we look at that, we want to make sure that all technologies are part of this and start really getting our hands around what is internet access, what can people use. I don't think that people particularly care whether it's a satellite, whether it's a fiber to their home, or whether it's their wireless device. They just want to be able to connect and do what they need to do to engage in Florida's commerce. With that, I will happily answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Reed. Members of the committee, do we have some questions for the providers? Representative from Miami-Dade County, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentations. I'm familiar with both the Essentials and the Access program and several others across a couple of different providers. And both of you have identified in different levels of the underutilization of those programs. I would highly recommend some targeted paid outreach, and I'm happy to work with you on that, because there are a lot of folks, once I tell them about it, word of mouth, oh, this is great, but most of them just don't know. And if this has not already been in consideration, to make sure those communications and whatever outreach efforts are done in Spanish and Haitian Creole.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Vice Chair from Palm Beach County, Broward County.
Close, very close. Actually, closer to Palm Beach County than most parts of Broward. But thank you, Mr. Chair. If I might, and I'm going to say that I'm going to ask this question and just paint a real quick picture. I know we've got a tip off coming up, and we got a clock we're watching. But we passed a bill 2 years ago with regard to undergrounding, and the two gentlemen who were here and most of the utilities outside of the power that we're working with that process have worked very hard to try to accommodate some of these things. But the utilities, when I say utilities, the power utilities were what we were putting underground. And it just so happens where some of these first projects are happening are in my district, actually in the city where I live. And I know that Mr. Dudley and Mr. Reed have both tried to get their folks to work with the power utilities. But when you dig a hole and put power underground, you want to make sure you have additional, whether it's to set it for later or not, it doesn't make a lot of sense. And it's not critical of the bill sponsor from when we did it, but it doesn't make a lot of sense to leave poles up that it can be exposed during a hurricane, especially now when most people are working from home and using whether it's Zoom or WebEx, but using teleconferencing for their lives. So if the power comes back on, that's great. The air conditioning comes back on, the refrigerator's on. But if you can't work from home, it's a challenge. So I want to have some conversations in the future about how we make sure, whether it happens, what's going on right now, or future projects, where we do that. And I know it has a lot to do with what you all can't do with respect to ratepayers. So I want to find a way to resolve that so that you all can be hardened as well and make sure we move forward with that.
Thank you. Additional questions? Seeing none, real quick, Mr. Dudley, you had mentioned the federal monies that just recently became available. Do you have any idea how they plan to deploy that, if they're going to do it by states, by need, or if they're going to do it for local municipalities by need,
right,
general areas?
It was a reverse auction, so the companies that bid placed bids based on specific projects and locations. So it may have been, three locations in Jackson County where people a bid on providing service there. The FCC awarded what they thought was the best bid. And then, as I mentioned this Friday, the companies that won those bids in Jackson County or were awarded that money have to submit the detailed plans on what type of technology, deployment plans, how soon, how they will do that. And then the FCC will be looking at those plans to determine if the plan is consistent with the requirements of the federal program. Does it meet those requirements? Is it real? A lot of other things. So I don't think that money, the $191 million, it's been awarded. It's now, the details are being submitted, and they're going to be reviewed over the next several months. And I imagine you'll see those awards go out the door. The money goes to the carriers or to the entity that won the bid to deploy consistent with the plan they're submitting tomorrow or Friday, excuse me. Okay. If that helps.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Dudley. Well, members, it's 5:14, so I think we've utilized our time very well today. Presenters, we thank you for being here and providing some background from your daily walk through life, and you understand and recognize our needs throughout our communities. And Director Eagle, we appreciate you being back here. And with that, Vice Chair LaMarca from Broward County moves we rise. Show that done without objection.